Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Savakis.
And I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome back to ANCAST. So we've been gone for a couple of weeks. We really needed some time off after getting back from Japan, because jet lag is a fucker.
Like, yeah. I think it was especially bad this year because of the time our flight came in. We arrived at 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know about you, but I went home and crashed out about noon and then woke up at, like, midnight.
Yeah, pretty much. I managed to make it till about 3 o'clock and then woke up at, like, 10 p.m., and then, you know, basically spent the next week in a state of waking sleep, and I'm still getting over it. I'm not completely over it yet, but
yeah, it's
whatever.
Rough.
It's spring, and the crappy thing is the minute I got back the next day, spring preview starts, which is the busiest time of the year for me. Really, really, really hectic. Lots of work to do. It could not have come at a worse time. So I'm frazzled, and I've been frazzled, and will probably be frazzled for another couple of days. So.
Right.
Yeah, I apologize if suddenly I don't know, burst out into song or disconnect or something.
Hey, you know what? The former would be good radio. The latter would just bring the show to a halt.
Right. So before, we're going to talk about the spring shows in a bit, but something else popped up that we just had to see for some reason. I think like they just decided to premiere it this weekend. The fabled live-action Van Von Hunter showed up on Crunchyroll. Stu Levy's quote-unquote masterpiece.
Starring Yuri Lowenthal, voice actor extraordinaire.
Yeah, friend of the show. He's been on.
Yeah.
Yuri's a great guy.
Really that, shouldn't be in a loincloth.
The movie's a fucking train wreck. Like, it's terrible. Like, it boggles the mind that somebody would A, produce something like that, and B, want people to see it. Like, it's really embarrassing. I feel really bad for Yuri, because he's a nice guy, and he's clearly, you know, trying his hardest in this thing. And it's such a bad idea, badly executed, it's not funny, it's just fucking humiliating for everyone involved. I'm shocked that, I guess I'm not shocked. I mean, from what I know about Stu, he's, you know, a few bats short of a belfry. I guess it doesn't surprise me that he would think that this is good, but it's horrible. Like, I got through like 30 minutes of it, and I started skipping through it because our friend Summer Mullins is in the film.
Oh, she's in it too?
Yeah, at the very end, she's got a cameo appearance.
Yeah, so is Shoji Kawamori and a handful of other anime industry stalwarts. But the thing is, this movie, from what I've heard and from what we've been told, was shot more or less over the course of years at various cons and in Japan and in LA with no script.
Right.
And it shows. What it looks like is a combination of 5 aborted various video and film projects, 2 of which were documentaries, strung together in a piecemeal fashion with the attempted showmanship and bravado of a freshly out of high school film student.
Yeah, that's a good description of it. Once it gets to the like Borat ripoff parts, which happen later on in the film, I don't think you saw those. But they try to do a couple of those like fake interviews where the other person doesn't know that it's a fake interview or whatever.
What gives it away? The extreme overacting by 40-year-olds. You know, there's there's a certain cutoff when it comes to amateur filmmaking. There is a certain cutoff at which, at a certain age, you really can't get away with certain things anymore.
Yeah,
almost everyone, both on and off camera on this project, is way too old to be doing this stuff and way too old to be showing it to people proudly.
Yeah, and that's what gets me. And you know, and I hate to shit on it too much, but it really is.
No, you don't. You've been looking forward to this.
No, I mean, because I feel bad for Yuri. I really do. He is a nice guy. And it pains me to see him in this. And it's probably, like, as far as I know, like, his most prominent live-action role. Otherwise, he's always, you know, behind the mic.
Right.
And so I feel bad for him, because it's really terrible. Really terrible. And it doesn't work at all, and it's just a fucking nightmare. So, you know, I think it's still up. I think it's still on Crunchyroll. So if, you know, some of you out there have a thirst for schadenfreude and pain, you know, it's still there. You can check it out. But, ugh, God, Van Von Hunter. Why? Like, some people, I guess, are just so delusional that if they created it, it's great. And they actually think people should see it. I don't know.
I was getting film school flashbacks. Like, you know the class where you're just sitting through everyone's work and everyone is obviously completely new at this. No one has any idea how to tell a story or the various steps involved in making a film. But everyone is really, really proud and you know, you point out the mistakes and they're like, that was intentional.
Or pointing out the mistakes makes you the asshole.
Right.
Like, you're the jerk if you tell someone that there's flaws in their work, which defeats the purpose of learning and makes those early film school classes, nobody really learns that much. Because even like I remember my professors, I had a professor who would rely on me. Like, he didn't want to be the asshole. So he would rely on me to say, like, hey, there's a problem with that shot, or, you know, the story doesn't make any sense in here. Because he didn't want to be a jerk.
Oh, yeah, same here. And, you know, the kids get really bent out of shape if you try to correct them. So, really, the only thing I learned my first year of film school is how long I could have the barrel of the gun in my mouth before my jaw started hurting.
Yeah. Hey, it's not like I was turning out masterpieces anyway. My stuff was shit, too.
Hey, no one shall see my student film.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But I was willing to admit that it was flawed and try to improve it, not just reject all criticism or reject all, like, even technical criticism. So I can imagine that I don't think Stu is listening when I don't think Stu listens to this podcast, and I'm fairly sure he's not interested in what we have to say about his movie anyway. So there you go.
Certainly the guy was expecting a little blowback, even with the amount of ego required to release something like this.
All right. Well, we've just talked about Van Von Hunter for 10 minutes, which is 9.5 minutes longer than anybody should talk about Van Von Hunter.
Yeah, so, true. You're going to have to cut that down a bit, I think.
Oh, no, I'm not cutting any of it. but anyway, so the spring season has started, much to my dismay.
Yeah.
Because it means a mountain of work for me, but there's actually been good stuff this season.
There has. I mean, I've only seen two of the shows so far, but I enjoyed both of them.
What did you watch?
I saw Hero Man, which is much better than it should be given its premise.
Yeah,
it's heartwarming and really, really well animated. This is the best looking and, frankly, the most accurate I think anyone has ever depicted America in anime.
Yeah, it's kind of stuck in the 90s a little bit, but yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, there's that's just part of the aesthetic, and frankly, it takes place in Southern California. And they don't show it like, oh, there's L.A., there's the city lights. No, this is shitty, dingy strip mall. These are sickly-looking palm trees. Exactly like it actually is.
Yeah, it's kind of like North Hollywood.
Right.
Which is accurate. You know, that's what Los Angeles is like, for the most part.
Actually, I think they scouted around Torrance.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah,
it looks exactly like Torrance. But I mean, I have to admit, like, I was, first of all, like, I'm on record saying that I think Stan Lee cameos are fucking tired, and I really hate it when he pops up in a movie. It's so played because he's been in like half a dozen films at this point, and when he shows up, it's like all the nerds in the audience are supposed to be like, "Oh, Stan Lee," but it's old at this point. Like, we get it. And he was in this, and it's like, all right. But the show is so high quality in terms of just production value that I could kind of overlook the fact that the script was really straightforward and really predictable and really just packed with the same kind of origin story superhero cliches that we're used to. I don't think at any point in that episode you are at all confused about what's about to happen next.
No.
Which is fine. It's a high quality show. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing where it is at episode like 10.
Right. You know? By then, the initial charm, which it has plenty of, will have long since worn off, and it might actually have to tread new ground.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if the animation holds up.
That's the Aniplex, other big question mark.
Yeah, well, Aniplex is no Gonzo. It's not like they're just going to suddenly, or Bones is no Gonzo. It's not like they're just going to suddenly drop the ball.
Right.
So, like, episode 2 looks like it was animated by an elementary school class or whatever.
Bones has always been very consistent quality-wise.
Yeah.
I'm told that they were aiming for a U.S., a simultaneous U.S. broadcast with this, but, well, trying to get anime on U.S. broadcast TV is just a non-starter these days.
Yeah, having seen it, though, it's a no-brainer. Like, it belongs on American television. It's good enough. You know, it's quality enough show. I think American kids would really like it.
I do too. I think this could have done very well on American TV if they could just get carriage. And frankly, that's really, really hard. There's really only 3 or 4 TV networks that will even consider anime. And, you know, if they pass on it, you're pretty much sunk.
Well, I think one of the big problems with it is that you can't exactly strip it. You can't run it 5 days a week, 6 days a week. How many episodes is this even planned for? Like 13?
I don't think they know yet.
However long they can continue producing it.
Right. But, you know, they can't strip a show until there's, what, 50 episodes?
Well, right. So that might be why right now it's been passed on. But maybe a year from now it'll show up on American TV. I think that's where it belongs. Clearly that's what it was produced for.
Right.
And it's a shame that it's not out there already. But who knows? Maybe next year when they've got like 26, 50 episodes under their belt.
Assuming they last that long.
Yeah, that's true.
I really have no idea how much Japan goes in for this sort of thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to find out. I don't know if Japan will bite. Maybe they will. Who knows? Yep. But so the other thing you watched was
Big Wind Up 2.
Right. Which I have not gotten to yet.
I was a huge fan of the it's not so much gay as bi curious.
Right.
it's a really good, very likable baseball show, and I loved the first season, and I was really, really disappointed, along with every other fan of this show, that Funimation wasn't going to pick up the second one. So I'm left with the Japanese release, and I'm going to miss the dub, but it just picks up right where the last season left off, so it's basically just more of the same. If you're already invested in the show, you can pick it right up, dust it right off, and keep going. If you've never seen the show, you probably want to start with the Funimation discs.
How much manga material is left after the first season?
I think they have about 5 books, 6 books. The problem is that that manga comes out monthly, not weekly, so it moved really slow. So it was probably a really good thing they took a break for a couple years.
Yeah, so you think it's got enough steam for another full 13 or 26?
13 or 20. I think they could get 26 out of what they have right now.
That's good. With a conclusion? With an actual conclusion?
No, there's no conclusion. There is no conclusion. They could, if they just take it to the end of this baseball playoff season, I think that would probably be a good place to stop. But, you know, they're freshmen in high school, and there's clearly going to be a year 2 and 3 for them, so...
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's a shame that it didn't do well enough to get picked up, because I would like to watch it on DVD with a dub. But apparently that's not going to happen, as we broke on this show.
Right.
Which sucks. The thing I saw that I really liked was...
Kiss This.
I can't believe... Shut up. Wait a minute. What did you just say?
Isn't that what's called Kiss This?
I've never heard of that show. I don't know what you're talking about. All right. The thing I actually liked was... Kaicho Wa Maid Sama, which it's just a shoujo romantic comedy. It's not like an otaku sex comedy or anything.
Right.
I just enjoyed it. It was very enjoyable. And anything that doesn't make me, you know, want to hang myself gets a pass at this point. And that one I just found very funny. It really reminded me of Boys Over Flowers. It gave me that vibe.
Really?
Like super headstrong, self-reliant girl with a poor family. Winds up in a compromising position with a guy who seems like he's an asshole, but he's really kind and kind of charming.
Is he rich?
I don't know that he's rich. Probably. Mm. he's the coolest kid in school, that's for sure.
Well, all right then.
So, yeah, Boys Over Flowers. But the premise is basically she works part-time at a maid cafe to make ends meet, and he catches her and sort of starts using the situation to his advantage a little bit. Like, he doesn't screw her over with it yet, but...
He's clearly gonna.
Like he's kind of tormenting her with it a little bit, and she just doesn't want anybody to find out because it's embarrassing. So that's kind of the premise. It could get really creepy and terrible, but I don't think it will. And I've heard the manga's pretty good, so I'll probably keep watching it.
Well, I will give that one a shot. What else looks good? I mean, you just posted the first reviews of Night Raid, which I've been looking forward to ever since I saw the materials at TAF.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to it yet. We had to tape the show this afternoon, and I had to post a billion other previews, so right. I didn't have time to watch it. But it looks good, and everyone's saying it's getting like 4.5s and 5s and stuff. So
I mean,
that's the one that people like us have been looking forward to. So Everyone says it's great. I'm assuming it's great. Now that I understand what the premise is, I guess they're like superpowered supernatural spies or whatever in Shanghai in the 30s.
Tim Mahan said it was halfway between a Bourne Identity and Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, which sounds good to me.
Give me.
Other than that, like, I saw Working. I didn't write a preview of Working because I had nothing to say about it because it's so lightweight.
Four-panel gag manga turned anime.
Four-panel gag manga turned into an anime that... I mean, I had no objection to it. It was kind of cute. It just had no substance to it at all. And, like, it was as close to something that I could see, like... It felt like the anime version of an American sitcom. Like, that's... An American sitcom, like, with a laugh track on CBS or whatever.
Oh, no.
Which is fine. That's fine. It's not at all... doesn't have any of the creepy stuff going on. It's very clean. But I just didn't have anything to say about it. It was so insubstantial as to... it could have floated away. You know, it was that.
That's kind of a waste. I saw the premise and I was looking forward to it because having to work a shitty food service job as a teenager it's just rife with material.
Well, the thing you'll like about it is set in a Jonathan's.
Leave me alone.
It's not actually Jonathan's. It just uses the exact same font on the sign, and the interior looks exactly... it's clearly supposed to be a Jonathan's, but it's called, like, Wagnerium or something like that. But, I don't know. I'm probably not going to watch any more of it. It's just too lightweight. Mm. But, so it was that, and then... oh, Arakawa Under the Bridge, which, surprisingly, I didn't. Actually, I liked it for, like, the first 5 minutes, and then after that, I just lost all interest. I'm like, is that it? Is that all there is going on?
That was a slapstick one, right?
Yeah, it's based on a gag manga, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So,
I'm surprised you liked it at all.
Well, it reminded me initially of Cromartie High School.
Okay.
You know, real surrealist, kind of absurd sense of humor. You know, dramatic, over-the-top characters that take themselves too seriously in comedic situations.
What?
You know? Yeah, yep. Yeah. But the problem is it's 22 minutes of, what? Like, this guy having his mind blown over and over and over and over again about how just wacky and zany the situation he's in is.
And this, whenever he goes, what, the camera zooms in really tight on him and his face gets a really, really detailed and ugly.
Not the detailed and ugly, but this was directed by the same guy, and I wasn't aware of this, but directed by the same guy who did, like, Panty Pony Dash and a bunch of the other, like, Shaft comedies.
Oh.
And I guess that's a particular style, and I guess I'm just not fond of it, because it was way too... like, the camera was doing wild takes, which I guess is his style, like, quick zoom-ins on the, you know, if there's, like, a joke, and then it's, like, three quick zoom-ins on some scenery, or, like, here, let's run down this bridge really fast, and it's to punctuate a joke, which just feels too much. It's like watching a stand-up comedy routine where the guy looks right into the camera and, like, smiles really big after every joke. It's really off-putting. I didn't like it at all. It's not bad by any means. It's just not to my taste. And I was the only guy who didn't like it. So, yeah, there you go. Might be for you, not for me.
Interesting. So,
other than that, well, there's a few more coming up. We've got Rainbow, which looks pretty good.
Right.
And House of Five Leaves, which looks good.
Isn't Rainbow just basically an anime version of Sneakers, the Brad Pitt
movie? That's what I've heard. Not Sneakers, Sleepers.
Sleepers, yeah, Sneakers is the...
Dan Aykroyd.
yeah.
An anime version of Sneakers would be awesome, but it's anime Sleepers, which I've never seen, but I know the premise, and it's very similar.
Interesting.
But according to the guy I talked to at Nippon TV at Tokyo Anime Fair, it's based on a true story, I guess, so... who knows? Looks interesting.
Hmm. You've been having kind of a rough time this year as far as getting the source material to review this stuff, right?
Let me tell you, it breaks my heart. Where the hell are the simulcasts? They're not happening. There's like two, three, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm very upset by this because we made so much progress last year, and I don't know what's going on. Now, someone popped into the forums, Sam, this guy who lives in Japan, popped into the forums to sort of give us a... you know, brief, very brief thing about how, like, well, turns out it's not worth the time and money to simulcast things. It's too much of a headache. And I guess, and you've got some information on this, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was getting this from licensors too. Basically, you know, there were a lot of shows that got simulcast that just didn't make back the money it took to subtitle them.
And that's really sad, right? Because they're not spending much to sub these things.
Well, it's really sad, but you have to remember the economies of scale for streaming are so different. They're so much lower than DVD. DVD, you know, maybe you sell 500 to 1,000 units and you broke even on subtitle costs and then some. For streaming, you have to at least get, you know, 15 to 20,000 people watching.
Yeah, and that's not happening.
No, especially for, like, really, really niche shows like White Album and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, White Album tanked in Japan.
Yeah.
So, to some extent, the U.S. market is just not big enough to support getting everything Japan makes. And when we were getting almost everything Japan makes, that's when something's got to give, because there's just not enough eyeballs. It's right. Sort of like when ADV was and Genion, between the two of them, were releasing everything in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, there's just too much crap. And a lot of it is crap. So, yeah, the numbers aren't there. And, you know, if you're not making back the cost to copy the tape, and you know, once it's available simulcasting, you're not going to sell it to someone else.
In rare instances, you can, but yeah.
Yeah, rare instances, and if you are, it's going to be to, you know, Sentai Filmworks, and they're not exactly paying top dollar for this stuff. They're not even dubbing it.
Yeah, I think the only case we've seen where they, you know, somebody picked up a bunch of streaming stuff was Funimation just picked up a bunch of Gonzo stuff that happened to be streaming beforehand, but, you know, I don't know the story behind that, but that's the only time I think I've seen it really happen. But yeah, so I mean that's a crying shame. So what do you think? Where do you think the middle ground is? Do you think like Hero Man might actually, you know, justify the cost?
No. Do you think Hero Man's going to get 40,000 views on Crunchyroll?
40? No, 10 maybe.
10? Yeah, that's, you know, congratulations. The guy that did the deal can now buy lunch.
Man, so what's the solution? They just bring the prices way down to the point where no one's making any money on this stuff?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is something that everyone is working on. No one has really come upon a solution. But I think what this really comes back to is maybe what Sean Kleckner told us was right, and maybe this stuff really can't be completely free forever. There has to be... At some point, someone has to pay something for it because the ad dollars are just not there. And they're not going to be there for the foreseeable future. Even if ad costs, even if the ad rates double in the next year, they're not going to be something that can even come close to a shitty DVD release, revenue-wise.
Right.
Not even close. Not even on the same planet. One thing that we also have to remember is that Japan, the Japanese industry... They're in a deep recession. They've been in a deep recession for 15 years, and things are really starting to hurt over there.
Right.
I mean, everyone... I mean, there are a couple animation studios, and I can't name any names here. There are a couple known names in the Japanese anime production market that I am literally worried are going to close in the next year.
Ugh, that's a shame.
It's bad. What kind of happened was that when the bubble burst in the mid-90s, all the anime studios, in order to survive, started diversifying. Some of them got into the character business. Some of them previously worked for higher places like Madhouse or Production IG that would just be, you know, make me an anime, you know, that sort of place.
Yeah.
Now they're just, they've been making their own shows. They've been actually... grassroots, figuring out what to make, and then trying to get money for them, and then making them themselves, and then finding a distributor. Indie film, basically.
Right.
And as any indie film producer will tell you, when you self-finance, you are taking a huge risk, and there have been a lot of bombs lately.
Right. So these little, relatively small studios that, you know, were relying on a lot of foreign dollars, and the foreign dollars dried up. So then they started gambling with their own money, I guess.
We're not talking little studios here. Like Madhouse,
I thought you weren't supposed to name names.
Well, Madhouse, I can tell you, their parent company, Index, well, right now they're finishing up the new Satoshi Kon movie.
Right.
And that's a homegrown production. But after that, their parent company, Index, is looking at not really making any more of these. Their last homegrown feature, My Miracle, tanked pretty badly.
Wait a minute. Now, My Miracle, that just premiered at, like, New York, Manhattan Children's Film Festival, didn't it?
Yeah, in the States. Japan, it's already had its run.
Oh, jeez. I didn't even know it existed until it popped up on that festival list.
Well, that tells you it made an impact the size of a cashew.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah, so that tanked, and, you know, there have been a couple other projects like that for other studios. Where they pour all this money into it, and it just does nothing.
Man, so we will see for... You think we're just going to see more shrinking in the Japanese space?
Yeah, it's already started. Bandai Visual laid off 50 people out of 190 as of last month.
So, gloom and doom aside.
Right.
Who's doing well?
Who's doing well? Probably the people, it's hard to say for sure, but the ones who have diversified into character goods, i.e. the people, Ghibli could live off Totoro for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of Totoro crap you see everywhere, I mean, we were in Tokyo Hands and they had a big assortment of Totoro stuff.
Yeah. Tokyo Hands, for people who don't know, is the Japanese version of Michaels. Complete with framing section and, you know, latex flower assortment and stuff
right.
like that.
So, you know, if you control a One Piece or a Naruto, you're doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Or like
a major Moe title like K-On! Or something?
Yeah, to some extent. The otaku-centric titles have a shorter shelf life.
Right.
You know, people will be buying One Piece stuff until the end of time in Japan. K-On! Will be forgotten in 2 years.
Unless they do, like, season 3 and 4.
Right, exactly.
Because they just started season 2, so it's coming back now.
Exactly. One other thing that it looked for a big uptick in is feature films.
Yeah, which I'm actually kind of happy about.
Well, I think everyone's happy about, because it means, you know, it's less of a time investment for the viewer. It's harder to pirate before it's had a chance to, you know, get to Funimation and get to the people that might buy it in the U.S., because no one can really pirate it until the Japanese home video release comes out. But more importantly, people, just like in the States, in Japan, they're still going to the movies.
Yeah.
So that revenue can really be used to offset what DVD is not doing anymore.
Right.
So, that, and, you know, the late night TV anime, a lot of that stuff is just, it's not doing the numbers it used to. So, maybe the late night model is kind of dying. I mean, it's certainly not dead yet, and that's still how a lot of shows are being released, but, you know, those are infomercials for the DVD, and if no one's buying the DVD, why keep making them?
Now the Blu-ray, yeah. Yeah, no, I see. I mean, yeah, I could definitely... I mean, there's fewer shows this season than there were even last fall. So, by, like, a third. there's 22 shows now, 23, and there were, like, 32 last time. So...
Yeah, this industry is knee-deep in a pretty big transition, and I don't think things are going to stabilize for another year or two yet.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. It's a shame that people who took a gamble on, you know, more creative projects suffered as a result of that. But, you know, hey, they had a good run, I guess.
They did. And, you know, honestly, once people figure out the formula again, it'll be back to the same old, you know, let's push as much product out there as possible. And, hey, we might get better, more accessible product as a result. Who knows?
Yeah, well, there's more promising new stuff this season, and maybe the lack of simulcast will actually give some value to some of these things. Like something like Night Raid not being simulcast, well, that's probably a really... Funimation's probably very interested in that. So,
yeah,
you know, we'll see.
Well, you know, if you think about this from Funimation's point of view, it makes no sense to buy these things before they're finished.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, you can't tell from one or two episodes if a show's going to stay good.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last thing you want if you're Funimation is to buy Trinity Blood for a lot of money when it's at episode one or two and it's still good, and then get to the end and go, ugh. And I'm sure that has happened countless times.
Well, yeah, if you look at their catalog, it's happened a lot.
Oh, right.
Speedgrapher, for example. Okay, well, so I guess the lesson here is that we're gonna see some major changes over the next year, and it looks like shifting more towards theatrical and away from the late night model.
Yeah, and away from the really, really hardcore otaku-centric stuff, too, I think. And we've already seen that. There's so much less pink everywhere.
Yeah, that's true. Although I did watch about 10 minutes of that Mayoi Neko overrun.
I didn't say it was dead.
You're right. It's not. Its corpse lives on. And you know what? So long as there's an audience for those shows and they're buying things, that's fine. You know, hey, somebody's got to make money somehow. So,
Lord knows some people need to eat occasionally.
Yeah. Okay. Well, geez, we've gone on for like half an hour, like 35 minutes. We should probably bring the guest in.
All right.
Just for the record, I didn't volunteer for this job. 'Cause I'm not the Major. I can't replace her.
No one's asking you to.
So, is she still listed as missing?
Originally, all she could call her own was her brain and her ghost. But even she wasn't certain whether they were real or not.
Okay, we're back. Our guest this week is the author of Stray Dog of Anime, The Films of Mamoru Oshii, a noted anime scholar, I guess, definitely heavily involved in the world of anime academia, Brian Rom. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for being on the show. Up front, I guess we should say you're also a new ANN columnist.
Yes.
This hasn't been announced yet, but you do have a column coming up on Anime News Network, and I'm really excited about it. We don't want to get into it too much because it's not 100% yet. But basically, all the super smarty pants topics that you know people care about, you're gonna be getting into for us, which is an area we've sorely lacked in. So we're all very excited about that. But tell us.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
So am I. So how did you get involved in anime in academia, specifically as a field of study?
Well, I got into it because I really started thinking about this as something that I could do when I was graduating. I was finishing up my undergraduate degree, and I had a degree in philosophy, which basically, you know, really doesn't particularly qualify you to do anything. So I was looking around trying to figure out what exactly that I wanted to do. And I came across this book about Japanese popular culture, which I was like, okay, this sounds like, I'm an anime fan, and this is a book about stuff that I'm interested in. And in it, there was a chapter on Akira by this professor named Susan Napier. I was like, okay, that sounds cool. You know, I've watched Akira. I really like Akira, so I'm gonna read this. So I read it, and I was like, wow, this is really good. I didn't really know that you could actually, you know, write stuff like that about something like anime. So I thought, you know, maybe this is something that I could go on to do, you know, possibly in grad school. And so I ended up basically, kind of long story short, and I was living in Indiana at the time, and so I ended up moving down to Austin, Texas, and actually studying under Susan Napier, and I got my master's degree in Asian cultures and languages here at the University of Texas, and that's kind of how I got into it and really started writing and thinking about anime in that way.
And so where are you now?
Right now, as physically, I'm actually back in Austin, professionally, I am finishing up my a PhD in communication and culture, which is basically kind of a fancy way of saying media studies, communication studies, at Indiana University right now. So okay. I'm not in residence there, and you know, we just my family, we liked Austin so much that after I finished up classes, passed my exams at Indiana University, we decided to move down here. And so I've been, over the last few years, I've been slowly but surely finishing up my PhD dissertation, and hopefully there's not too much more to go on that.
Is your dissertation anime related?
Yes. It's on anime and globalization. And let me tell you, it's really kind of weird because a lot of the stuff that I was writing about, you know, about globalization and anime, things look so different now than they did when I started my dissertation. You know, writing an academic piece about stuff that's ongoing, it's, oh, I've had to like go back and revise things so many times, just to so that to stay current and, you know, not to make it look like I don't really know what I'm talking about. But.
Right. Well, I mean, dissertation process is what, like 3 or 4 years?
Yeah. It's
so, well, if you started 3 or 4 years ago, yeah, things are a lot different. Right. Definitely.
Erasing references to ADV.
Yeah, I do talk about ADV somewhat in a historical context.
Right.
Right. So, now the field of anime academia is sort of dominated by a couple of people. It seems like it's a really small field and probably very difficult to get into, I would imagine. You know, I know people who have dabbled, but there are like 3 or 4 names that everyone throws out. You're sort of on that list, and then there's Helen McCarthy, Susan Napier, Roland Keltz, but that's kind of it. Are you finding it? Has that been a real challenge? Because, and I sort of wanted to draw a parallel here, because if someone were to go up to you and say, "Hey, is this a viable career path?" What would you tell them?
As far as it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, you know, as a viable career path, I don't know. There, you know, I'm not sure if, in good conscience, I can really recommend going to grad school in the humanities, like I've been doing to people in general. I mean, it's a good way to, you know, pursue your interests, but as far as, you know, a way to be, you know, to make a living, I don't know about that. I mean, and I haven't even gone out on the, you know, on the job market looking for an academic job, and I'm not really sure that I'm going to kind of put myself out there looking for professorships and things like that. Just one of the reasons, because, you know, we moved back here to Austin, Texas, and I really like living and working here in Austin, and so I'm not really sure that I'm looking for a professorship. You know, because a lot of the times in academia, you have to go where the jobs are. So if there's a job in, you know, at a small liberal arts college in the middle of who knows where, well, you know, that's the one good job in media studies that might have come up this year. So, you know, if you get it, that's where you're gonna head, and, you know, you're gonna pack up, you know, your house and your family and all that kind of good stuff. So as far as a viable career option, there are much better ways of making money than going into academia, let me tell you. But as far as the names, the people that are out there, yeah, I mean, Susan Napier is definitely one of them. I don't think Roland or Helen, I mean, they write about anime and manga in a very learned and informed way, but I don't think they're actually in academia per se. I don't think that they're like professors or anything like that.
I guess I just sort of lump you all together in my head. As a plebeian, I can't help it.
People who've released books about studying anime. There's really only a handful. Right.
Gotcha. Well, and it's kind of funny because when I was finishing up my undergrad career. I was talking with a professor who was he studied Japanese governments, and I told him I was thinking of going on and into Asian cultures and languages, studying Japan, and he was really encouraging about that. And he was asking me what specifically about Japan I wanted to study, and I kind of hemmed and hawed, and I was like, well, I like anime and manga and things like that. And he's like, okay, well, that's fine to like, but you're never gonna, you're not gonna write a a book or a dissertation or anything like that on anime. I mean, that's just not the it's basically like that's not the kind of thing that is worthy of academic attention.
And you said you've never seen Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny how attitudes have just in. I mean, I graduated in my undergrad in '99. And just in the last decade or so, what with the kind of the I guess the bigger expansion of Japanese popular culture, at least on the cultural radar, that it's kind of become now more acceptable to take anime and to take manga as something that you would study and write about in a serious manner. So.
Well, yeah, like in the last 10 years, I have a friend who wrote his dissertation on fucking Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, cultural studies have come a long way in terms of popular culture being used for serious academic research.
Oh, yeah, there's tons of Buffy scholarship out there. It's crazy.
Buffy scholarship, God.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting, studying something like anime, you come across a lot of other people who are studying related things in a similar way.
I want to be a 30 Rock scholar.
I got my degree in Jersey Shore. So do you all, when you see each other at conventions, do you all give each other the look like, yeah, we got away with it?
not so much. Not so, well, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a good gig if you can get it. But like I say, not the most lucrative of careers if you want to talk financials.
Yeah, well, the parallel that I sort of, in terms of that, the parallel I kind of wanted to draw is that, when people ask me, hey, I want to write about anime for a living, usually I have to tell them, well, I hope you enjoy freelancing and then having a real job. Because I know 4 or 5 people that actually write about anime for a living full time, and I'm one of them. And so the jobs are not exactly plentiful. So unless one of us dies, the jobs are not really out there. It's fine as a freelance career if you can find the work, but it's not a super full-time thing. And it sounds like the academia thing for you anyway is kind of a side. It's something you're working towards, but you've got a fallback. You've got something that you do full-time.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So it's kind of nice because I'm living in Austin. I'm working at the university, but not in a teaching position. I'm working as a software developer. So, I guess I fall into the category of, I've become kind of an IT guy who, watches and writes about anime. And I've stereotyped myself now.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of IT guys who read and watch and who write about anime.
Right, our boss was one.
Yeah, he was a network administrator before taking over ANN. But just a minute ago, we were making fun of Buffy scholarship, and it's easy to make fun of Buffy scholarship because it sounds like bullshit. But you specifically are tackling, your focus is Mamoru Oshii.
Whenever possible, yes. I like to work him into any sort of conversation or any sort of writing on anime.
Right. Now, nobody's going to call bullshit on that because his films are as ponderous and difficult as I think you could probably get. You've obviously been through his entire filmography, everything he's ever done. What was the most, do you have a favorite of his? And if so, what was the most difficult one to sort of dig through?
I have to say my favorite Oshii film would be Pat Labor 2.
Yes, sorry.
I think that's that. of all the ones that are out there, I think it's the one that holds up the best, and it's got such a great soundtrack, and I think it's definitely kind of, you know, just describing an Oshii film as accessible, you're always going to have to qualify that, but I think it's still a fairly accessible film for an Oshii film. You know, he's not going off on to kind of, you know, innocence levels of being self-referential or anything like that.
He's not seeing how many correct quotes he can cram in there.
Right, right. Yeah,
I think the word is obtuse.
and it's got some great animation. It's got some great action scenes to it as well, and just the entire look and feel of the film. I just love it. So that one's definitely my favorite.
When I see Pat Labor 2, and, you know, I come back to it after, you know, years, and I keep finding new things. There are a couple themes that it touches on, both in terms of geopolitical structures and both in terms of, you know, just how we live our daily lives, that I feel like I get a lot out of. What thematically makes it such a drug for you? I use the term drug because that's what it is for me.
I really like it because the point of view that Oshii brings to the film is just, it's very, I think it's a lot more nuanced than you might get with a number of other films or, you know, a number of other directors, because like you were saying, this whole geopolitical take that he has on the role of, I mean, it's all about the role of Japan post World War II and how Japan should involve itself into world affairs, and the, you know, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution giving up the basically the right of Japan to have a military, and to, you know, and we see in the very beginning, in the very first kind of scene of the film, where the Japanese UN group is in Southeast Asia and they need to get specific permission to actually engage the enemy, and that ends up having dire consequences that kind of you can see carry throughout the rest of the film. And I really like it because it's a very questioning film. So, you know, I don't think that Oshii is necessarily questioning, you know, the stance of, I don't know if I want to say this, the stance of peace of, but the fact that this role has been kind of foisted upon Japan without, you know, because it's in the post-war constitution that the United States basically gave to Japan. And so it's kind of wondering what the kind of a role Japan should have, and also questioning Japan's ongoing support for the United States war efforts, you know, particularly, you know, like Japan was used as a base in, of course, Vietnam and Korea and things like that, and just, you know, Japan has profited in, you know, in the post-war period from its involvement in supporting U.S. military efforts abroad. And so, you know, he kind of pulls back and he thinks, you know, is, even though we're not actively fighting, what kind of a role and what kind of a duty do we have in all of these things that are going on in the world? So, that's kind of my take on it.
Right. Now, Pat Labor 2 is, I mean, I only saw it recently, like, you know, last year. And that is probably his most accessible film, maybe outside of Ghost in the Shell. Ghost in the Shell gets pretty weird. My other question was, like, having researched all of his films, you know, he wrote the book on the guy, which of his films was the most challenging for you to decipher, to figure out, like, okay, what was he doing here?
There's one that I still actually haven't really figured it out yet, I didn't write about it. I only basically mentioned it in passing in the book, and it was a 6-episode OVA series from, don't remember, I think it was the late 80s. I don't have my chronology in front of me, but it was called Gosenzo-sama Banbanzai, which basically translates to hooray for the ancestors. It's about this girl who travels through time to meet her, basically her ancestors, her grandfather and her great-grandfather. And it involves a lot of weird time travel and just a lot of odd humor. I mean, it's basically Oshii. If you gave Oshii at that particular point in his career, if you gave him carte blanche, which I think basically they did, he's like, here, you know, you can make something. You know, this is what Oshii came up with. I don't know that much about live Japanese theater, and the way that almost every scene in these OVAs are, it's staged very theatrically. It's basically that, you know, the characters are on screen and they're facing the audience, or, you know, kind of a slight angle, or, you know, facing each other. And it's a very flat way of presenting things. There's not a whole lot of dynamic action that's going on in a lot of it. I'm not really sure what to make of it. And so that's kind of, I haven't written anything about it. I just haven't really touched it because that's one that really confuses me, and I'm just not sure how to take it.
I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, it's pretty obscure. Well, and another reason that I didn't write about it for my book is because it hadn't been fan subbed or anything like that, and the only way to get a copy of it, the Japanese DVDs were and still are, like, you know, for six OVAs it's like $350 or something like that. So
I think there's been a fan sub that came out like in the last year, but
yes, yeah.
Not in time for your book.
Yeah. But I was just like, you know, okay, do I use my limited resources to get these DVDs, or do I just go on without, you know? So, you know, I'd seen a little bit when the book came out, but that was actually I hadn't managed to get a hold of that of those OVAs at the time that the book came out. So,
you know, I found Oshii's live action works particularly impenetrable.
Yeah,
particularly Red Spectacles.
Yeah, it's been a while since I watched that one too.
For those who don't know, Red Spectacles is the original work that from which he came up with the world for what became Jinro later. Mm-hmm. But it's live action and shot for what appears to be about $100.
10,000 yen.
Right.
Yeah.
I've never seen any of those, and it's one of those things where it's like, maybe I should see that, but I guess not.
No, I mean, you definitely I think you should see it. What you'll get out of it, you know, that's a totally different question. It's definitely, but I think Red Spectacles is a little bit more even in tone than the next one, than Stray Dog, which it's weird. It's kind of, sometimes it's quiet and meditative, and it has just these really interesting long tracking shots, but then sometimes it's got like just this slapstick humor, and just it really changes tones incredibly abruptly.
Isn't that the one where like there'll be like this really long ponderous shot where, you know, be like the main character smoking, and then suddenly out of nowhere he turns to the camera and grins really big?
Yeah. There's like a scene at the end where it almost seems like Oshii's like parodying like some sort of commercial or something like that, just like right in the middle of it, and then it just goes back to whatever the action was. It's an odd thing, let me tell you.
Well, great. Now anime has its own Cream Master Cycle.
The Cream Master Cycle.
Five of our listeners will get that joke.
I'm still one of, like, I think two people that's seen most of that.
I can't believe that you have seen most of that.
I was a bored Sunday, and they were running it at the Guggenheim. So
it takes dedication.
Right, dedication. That's what that was about. So, When I saw Innocence, I gotta say, like, and I wasn't completely a huge fan of Oshii. I like some of his stuff. To this day, Beautiful Dreamer was forced down my throat pretty hardcore when I was getting into anime, and everyone was telling me, this is amazing, this is the greatest. And from what I had seen of, like, the Lum TV series, I liked that TV series, and then they showed me that movie, which pretty much had nothing to do with the tone of the TV series. So I was like, what the F is this shit? Eventually, I grew to like it. I grew to love it.
That's the same reaction that that most of the Japanese fans had at the time too.
What the F is this? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's become a classic over the years. When I saw Innocence, it struck me in the same way that Howl's Moving Castle did, in that now here is a director who is such a monolithic artistic presence, no one is keeping him in check. And to that end, I thought Innocence was really just obtuse and self-indulgent and ponderous, and we get it, he loves his basset hound. And I sort of felt like this guy has become too big for his own good, and his films are suffering as a result, like Miyazaki has done with Howl's Moving Castle, and I think to an extent Ponyo. You know, no one's telling him, hey, this script should make sense or be interesting.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I could definitely see that. It's also one of the, Innocence was, I think, one of the first films, or one of the first in a while, where Oshii, in addition to directing, he also did the script himself. So I think you can probably see that reflected in the end product as well.
Well, that's another parallel, because that's what Miyazaki's problem is, too.
You know, one thing about that is, I had the exact same opinion of Innocence until I saw it dubbed, and thing is, Innocence is such a mood piece that the very fact that you are trying to parse these giant subtitles filled with, 18-letter words and trying to make sense of these really deep things while taking in the visuals, it's too much. I needed the dub to be able to just kind of let that stuff wash over me and just kind of lose myself in the mood.
You know what? I've never actually watched Innocence dubbed, so maybe I should.
There's actually two dubs on the new Bandai Blu-ray to make up for the old DreamWorks disc not having any. But, one is the weird, not really faithful, badly researched dub they did for Manga UK, and they dubbed that at 25 frame, so they had to slow it down for the U.S. release, and it sounds really weird because it's still Crispin Freeman, but he's talking like this.
That's weird. Talking about tone and, like, abrupt tonal shift, Innocence goes from 2.5 hours of two guys walking around quoting the Bible, and then they're karate fighting sex robots at the end. So, a little bit of a jump there.
Well, that's what my day normally is, Zach. I mean,
yeah. So, aside from Oshii, which is what you're sort of known for, I never really hear you talk about other anime that you personally enjoy. Anything more recent? What are you into? What do you like?
Yeah, I really got into I really got into anime because I was big into science fiction. Like, In high school, I really started getting into, like, cyberpunk and beat literature and things like that. I was reading William Gibson and things like that, and, a big fan of Blade Runner. And so I was looking for, I had watched a lot of anime, on TV when I was growing up, things like, Voltron and Star Blazers and Robotech and Transor Z and things of that nature. But yeah, I didn't kind of rediscover anime until high school, and I was getting into science fiction, and I saw stuff like Gunbuster and Bubblegum Crisis and things like that. So that's kind of what I definitely lean more towards, the science fiction kind of stuff in general. As far as stuff that I've been watching recently, I probably, like a lot of people, I start, watch the first few episodes of a show, and quite often, I'll just drop it. So, I've started watching, or I will start watching maybe a few things this season. I've been hearing really good things about that Kiss Sis show.
What? I've never heard of that.
Oh, really? Really?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, okay. I've heard it's going to be like a great breakout hit or, you know, something like that.
It's not on my radar.
Okay, okay. I didn't figure it would be. It's kind of a horror. But actually, the last show that I totally watched all the way through, like a 24-episode show, was a certain scientific railgun, which is, I thought was... It was good when it was doing like some major story arcs, but it really had some bad problems and some really crappy otaku bait filler when it wasn't kind of into the main story arcs. But when it was on, I thought it was on. I thought it was really good. But you know, again, it's not a show that I think recommend wholeheartedly to anybody because of, you know, it's got so much, you know, otaku pandering in it. So I kind of block those things out of my memory about the show. There was a point when I was watching it and I was questioning myself. I was like, you know, am I really going to kind of push through the, you know, all this crap and filler for some, you know, for some good, some decent animation and some storytelling that may or may not happen. And I did end up finishing it. That's probably the most recent show I've totally watched.
Well, there hasn't really been a lot of science fiction lately.
Yeah.
I think the last, I've never seen it, but that show Deno Coil is supposed to be pretty good. And I guess that's based on some major Japanese sci-fi thing, but the last serious sci-fi thing I saw, I think, was Crest of the Stars, which was a fucking long time ago.
Almost 10 years, dude.
It's 10 years. Well, I saw all of Crest of the Stars, so, you know, that was 2003 or so when the last one came out. But there hasn't been a lot of, like, super hardcore sci-fi stuff like that. If it is, then it's, you know, half otaku pandering, half sci-fi, right, like you were saying.
The only thing I can think of is Titania, which was basically a reboot of Legend of Galactic Heroes.
Wasn't that supposed to be shit?
Yes.
that was one of the ones that I watched the first episode of, and I just, you know, didn't get around to watching any else of it. So,
and for the record, I'm not counting mech shows here. I'm talking about just straight sci-fi.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because otherwise you could point to, like, you know, Aquarian or whatever. So, aside from Oshii, what other big directors, you know, auteurs are you sort of drawn to, besides Miyazaki?
I'd say Miyazaki up through Princess Mononoke, I really like, you know, stuff after that, not so much.
Really? Spirited Away?
Spirited Away just didn't do it for me.
Wow, second person on this show didn't like Spirited Away. We must attract him, because Chris Beveridge is talking about how he couldn't get through it. That's amazing.
I mean, I've watched it a number of times, but it's, I don't know, and maybe it's how I came into it, because Princess Mononoke was actually my first Miyazaki. And wow. I thought it was such a kind of a high point. You know, I thought it was so good, and I don't know. I just thought Spirited Away was, I don't know, kind of let me down.
Well, it was really the first Miyazaki film that felt a little pointless to me. It was so much fun that I didn't care that much, but it really didn't have that much of a point. It was just the first a whole bunch of stuff that happens Miyazaki film, I thought.
Yeah, Ponyo being the logical end of that.
Right.
Right.
Shit happens, you know?
Yeah.
And you wonder why you watched it at the end.
But hey, you know what? We bought the Ponyo DVD, and my daughter really likes it. And so, you know, I guess that's, you know, if you're 5 years old, you know, I guess you're not really concentrating on that kind of stuff.
Well, that's your problem if you're 5 years old and you can't get that stuff yet.
I don't know. I bought the Ponyo Blu-ray just to look at it, because it's a beautiful film. Right. I really like Tina Fey's performance in it, but I haven't finished it on Blu-ray yet. Mostly just watched that tsunami scene again. But anybody else like
he hasn't done a whole lot, but I really like Mamoru Hosoda. Girl Who Left Through Time and Summer Wars. I mean, I thought Summer Wars was a fantastic film.
Yeah, he's kind of the new golden boy. He's everyone's new favorite. Are you a fan of Satoshi Kon at all?
You know, I like his stuff well enough, but there's something about his films that bug me in some way that I can't describe. I don't know I haven't really looked at them with. Whenever I've been watching a Kon film, it's been as a fan. I haven't really been sitting down and trying to necessarily. Well, except for Perfect Blue, I've written a little bit about Perfect Blue, but not really any of the other films. So yeah, I don't. I mean, I like Kon well enough. I guess I'll say that. But you know, he's not one of my favorites or anything like that.
Interesting.
Well, what about some lesser anime directors? Are there any that obviously I kind of get into the more obscure stuff. So are there any anime auteurs that maybe aren't household names that are on your radar?
Let me see. You know, I really like what's his name? Hiroyuki Imaishi. He directed Gurren Lagann, and he also directed that Dead Leaves film. So, I mean, he definitely approaches it from he's definitely, I don't know, I think Oshii is he's kind of a writerly director, maybe. I mean, he's not an animator himself, but I mean, Imaishi and Imaishi and Miyazaki, I mean, they're definitely kind of animator directors, you know, coming at the film from or the TV show from those kinds of points of view.
Right, you know, they're all about the spectacles of draftsmanship.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I really love some of the stuff that Imaishi said, but you know, I mean, Dead Leaves is not the most intelligent film in the world.
It's hard to argue for that being high art.
Yeah, but I don't know. As far as the animation and the spectacle goes, you know, I'll buy into that, sure.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got some Twitter questions for you here, so let's go ahead and dive into those.
All right, shoot.
Before we do that, though, anything coming up from you that you wanted to plug? Obviously, aside from your upcoming Anime News Network column.
Yes, I'm going to have an ANN column. Let's see. As far as I actually it just came out either last month or the month before, a book called World Cinema, I think it's called World Cinema Directory Japan. It's a book all about Japanese cinema, and I didn't edit it or anything. A guy named John Barra in the UK did, but I contributed a number of individual film reviews, and I wrote kind of a longer piece on anime in that book. So that's probably the most recent thing that I've written that's come out. So yeah, I'll plug that. It's a really good book. You should take a look at it.
Cool. Okay. Okay. From Ed Sizemore, everyone's favorite guy, Ed.
Yep.
Would you ever consider doing an updated and expanded version of your Oshii book?
I would certainly, definitely consider it if any publishers would want to have it. One of the things that I didn't like about the book that I wrote, it's kind of weird to say that, but when I wrote it and when I was proposing when I made the proposal to the publisher, I already had, I had a couple chapters written, and they saw the chapters and they're like, oh great, if you want to do this book, we'll give you a contract and give us a finished copy by, I don't remember how many months from now. And I was like, well, that's not like a whole lot of time. You know, I really only have these chapters written. And that was basically the time frame that they were looking at in order to get it out. So, when I was writing the book, I was really kind of having to rush to get some things out. And so one of the critiques that I've heard of about the book is that, there's a fair amount of, there's some plot synopsis in there. I've heard that criticized as padding before, and I can certainly see where some people might be coming from with that critique. And so if I was going to do another book, I would it probably wouldn't even be a revised edition. It would probably be like I would want to really kind of take my time and have enough time to go into it and to write as much as I wanted to. Yeah, I would totally redo my approach to Oshii's films if I was going to do another book on him. But yeah, I mean, there's been so much that's come out since my book came out. I mean, my book only covers up through like 2000, 2001, and he's done so much more since then that, you know, I mean, you know, my book doesn't even cover Innocence or Skycrawlers or, you know, a film like Tachiguishi Retsuden, which, you know, it's a film that came out in 2006, which is kind of a live-action animation hybrid that I think is incredibly funny, actually. It's kind of weird to say that about an Oshii film, but yeah.
Nobody's seen it because I don't even think anyone ever translated it faithfully. The only subtitled version I've ever seen ever floating around, other than the festival prints the festival film prints that came from the distributor, were really bad Hong Kong boots.
Yeah, no, of course, it's available on DVD in Japan. It actually came out on DVD in France also, so you can get a version with French subtitles.
Whoa.
Which doesn't really
help.
For some reason, it kind of makes sense to me that the French might like Oshii and like this film in particular.
Of course, but it does.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. There's not a good version out there with intelligible English subtitles.
Also from Ed, what works of anime and manga academia have had the most profound effect on you, and what academic work currently going on excites you?
Well, as far as an influence goes, I definitely have to say Susan Napier. I mean, her that article that I was talking about before that kind of set me on the path to studying anime and manga, and her book that came out in what is like 2000 or 2001, anime from Akira to Princess Mononoke, and I was actually lucky enough. I started studying here at UT when she was kind of in the final stages of finishing up that book, and I got to kind of look at some of the early chapters on that, and that was kind of a cool experience. But yeah, so that book and a lot of Susan's work in general, I think, was pretty influential to the way that I approached anime. As far as what's going on right now, I mean, there is so much, you know, a lot of new stuff that's going on. You know, a lot of people who don't write about anime from necessarily from a Japanese studies perspective. I mean, people who are really into film have, you know, I've seen people write about anime from those perspectives, or people who are, you know, into fan studies have, you know, written intelligent articles. People who write about sexuality, you know, writing about anime and particularly manga. So, you know, there's a whole, I think the field of being able to write intelligently and academic articles about these things, it's really opened up. And yeah, I think it's definitely a good thing. And the fact that there are so many more people and so many varied opinions out there, you know, with, you know, kind of intelligent ways to back up their arguments. I mean, I think that's definitely a positive.
From Alex Leavitt, I'll parse here. What was it like doing research and writing a book on a major, you know, media producer in Japan? It was difficult to get connections to finish the book, and, you know, that sort of thing. How tough was it, I guess, to write on a foreign figure?
Well, I mean, the weird thing is that, you know, I wrote this book on Oshii, and I never actually, still to this day, I haven't met the guy. When I was in the process of doing my research for the book, one of the places that I hung out online a few years ago, there was the Production IG, the film studio that Oshii works with often. They had a really good English language forum, and, you know, a lot of people that I knew were kind of hanging out there, and a lot of the and a few of the production IG staffers in Japan would actually kind of post on the forum. And so I said to some people there that I was starting this book on Oshii, and, you know, oh, hey, look, I actually have a book contract, and that kind of opened some doors. And I actually made a special research trip to go to Tokyo and to meet with Oshii and to interview him in person. And this was all arranged through the contacts that I'd made online through the production IG forums. And unfortunately, when I was there, Oshii was sick and he wasn't able to meet with me, which was, you know, a major disappointment. But I did get to go into the production IG studios and see some things, and I got to see some clips from Innocence before it came out, and so that was exciting. But my actual interactions with Oshii and kind of doing research in Japan were kind of limited.
Okay, from Hisui RT, what topic would you be most interested in to write your next book about, and have you had any ideas for a new book that had to be scrapped?
I haven't scrapped any ideas a while ago, and this is still something that I have kind of on the back burner. But I really want to do a book of essays, kind of a collected book of essays on Evangelion. And even a few years ago, I put out like a call for papers, like for people to get me, give me kind of chapter ideas and proposals, and I've been a very bad editor, and I haven't really gotten back to people on that. And this, you know, this has been a project that I've been wanting to do for years, and I've just never quite been able to find the right, you know, environment or the right time to proceed with that. So I wouldn't say that book plan was scrapped, but it's something that I do want to do someday. My next book, I think I would like to do something on science fiction, anime, and manga, kind of a critical guide to it, perhaps. And that's another idea that I've been kicking around. And I've also come up with this idea. I'd really like to do a book on Go Nagai, who, I mean, there's tons of, you know, he's been incredibly influential, especially oddly enough, in Europe and the Middle East, actually, he's very popular. But I'd really love to write some more on his works as well. But any sort of project, any sort of additional project that I would have is really just in the early kind of research and brainstorming stages right now.
Right. Okay. All right. Last two from Rob Comet. In your book on Oshii, you mentioned that. He commented that Avalon would be his last collaboration with Kazunori Ito, which it was. And he wanted to know if you had any more insight into why they parted ways after years and years of working together.
I honestly don't. No. So kind of a short answer to that. I'm not really sure. Right. I'm not really sure what transpired there.
All right, then. Maybe. I was actually talking to the guy from Production IG at Tokyo Anime Fair, and I was joking with him, like, hey, if you ever can get me an interview with Oshii, you know. And I was kidding. But he's like, well, the last interview he gave was to Italian Men's Vogue, and that's pretty much it. I'm like, well, I'm never going to talk to him, but you wrote a book about him, so maybe one day you'll get to actually sit down and interview him. Finally, from Rob Comet, do you spend hours and hours sitting around coming up with a catalog of puns for Twitter, or are you just that gifted?
I guess I'm that gifted. You know, all the puns that I come up with on Twitter are usually just kind of spur of the moment. You know, it's nothing that I'm really writing and saving for other times. It's just, you know, the inspiration's got to strike me, and I'm like, you know, it's a perfect opportunity for a pun. And if I think that there's a perfect opportunity for a pun, I cannot resist it, no matter how odd or inappropriate it might be. So that's me. That's what I do.
All right, then. Okay, well, we're about out of time, but thanks so much for coming on and chatting with us. And, you know, everyone can look forward to your upcoming column.
Yeah, cool. All right, thanks a lot.
All right, that's our show for this week. I want to thank Brian for joining us. As always, remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And until next week, Hikai J.